Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Hallie Checco. Today, I have a special guest who has been on the show twice before and is, as of today, joining me as a permanent co-host. It has been an incredible journey starting and growing this podcast, and I'm so proud of everything we have accomplished over the last 2.5 years. Last year, I took the podcast independent, which is me and our engineer, Kyle Moore, and decided it was time to bring on a co-host to help us produce more better shows. And who is better than my friend and longtime digital health investor, Steve Krause? Steve, I am so excited to have you here today and also as my new co-host of the show.
Back at you, Hallie. It's super exciting to be here, be part of Heart of Healthcare officially. I know, having worked with you, that we're going to have a lot of fun working together, and we're going to have a lot of fun with our guests as well. You and I, for a long time, have both been healthcare nerds. That is true. And so my hope is that we're going to continue to tackle deep topics around healthcare that educate our listeners, both about cutting-edge innovations as well as critical issues facing our industry.
I love it. So listeners, here's our vision for the show going forward. Here's what won't change. The show will continue to be released weekly on Monday mornings for your Monday morning commute. We want to start the week with you. And we'll continue to bring on great guests that are founders and industry leaders. If you want to be on the show or want to recommend someone, you can always submit on our website, heartofhealthcarepodcast.com. It's in the show notes as well. And then on top of that, Steve and I will be producing a special monthly episode to talk about the digital health tea industry news and share our perspective on what's to come. We won't gossip too much, only a little. And today is going to be one of those special monthly episodes. We're going to talk about stuff in March.
Well, let's get started, Hallie. Let's do the news.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so we both picked three headlines. Why don't you start? What are the three headlines that have been on
your
mind?
Well, Hallie, I know you're a mom. I'm a dad, and I'm sure we both read Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. I'm sure you've done that. It's a great book. It's really bad this week for UnitedHealthcare. It's been a bad couple of weeks, to say the least. Obviously, one of the largest, most important companies in our industry, and just like two bad back-to-back headlines, right? The first, probably a lot of entrepreneurs are in industry and providers know that, you know, United owns Change Healthcare, which runs a lot of the back office of healthcare in terms of the actual interface and interchange, both how doctors get paid, how prescriptions get filled. That Change Healthcare got attacked by a cybersecurity hack, which has really made payments and prescriptions fulfillment of those challenging. And then this week announced that the United States government has launched an antitrust investigation into healthcare giant UnitedHealth on multiple fronts, you know, having to do with being a leading manager of drug benefits. They own lots of doctor groups, as you know, around the country. And so
unrelated, though, it wasn't triggered by
no
the cyber
two
attack,
separate
right?
news. Yeah, I mean, talk totally about unrelated. A bad day in the C-suite. Yeah. What's I mean, you know, lots of concern here. What's your take, Hallie?
Yeah, well, so I'm not sure if this has been confirmed, but it was supposedly state-sponsored Russian cyber attack. So that scares me, right? Like this new type of warfare that is targeting our healthcare system. So it's scary, right? And it's not being covered. We're not reading about this in mainstream news.
Right. I mean, Ty, I remember once an entrepreneur told me that lots of money spent by financial insurance services companies on maintaining your credit card, the security of that. But think about what's more sacred. It's your genetic code, right? It's your health information. And frankly, I think that, you know, health information is a huge honeypot. So honestly, I think this takedown of change is, you know, flash back to a year ago, you're an investor in companies, you're an advisor in companies, and Silicon Valley Bank went down.
Oh, yeah.
And our entire ecosystem was really, really teetering there, right? I know a lot of my companies were worried about making payroll. And actually, you know, I just think this is starting to get covered. But frankly, the AMA, the AHA, doctors aren't getting paid. You know, they're not getting paid because they can't file their insurance bills.
This is worse. There's no one to bail them out. This is worse. Like, more people are impacted, and SUV, as crazy as it was, as intense as it was resolved rather quickly. I mean, this has been, it's Tuesday, March 5th when we're recording this. It's 2 weeks now.
The Biden administration, there's talk of I think, on Congress of doing something to help the doctors, which I think needs to happen, right?
Yeah.
And then not to mention prescription. Think about prescriptions.
Oh, God.
Like, if you're you're someone who has a chronic disease and you need to actively manage your disease and you can't fail your prescription because the interchange is down. So I guess.
So I saw that United may have just paid $22 million in Bitcoin as ransom fee. So do the math on that. How much is that per record that they have?
Oh, my God. I mean, it's not a lot, right?
Nothing.
I mean, I read that United made $22 billion in profit last year. So, it's a small drop in the bucket.
And I think then, those hackers could have gotten more.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. They may get more. And then the second big bad piece of news for United is this antitrust investigation. And on the one hand, United is it's a very large entity in our industry, and it has acquired a lot of doctor groups. And there is rumor mill that there's been some rumors, and I don't know all the details, but in the Wall Street Journal is talking about how United, the insurance company, will cut more favorable deals with the doctors that they own than other doctors in a similar, geography. And of course, that would be anti-competitive behavior, right? That's sort of, that'd be the negative side. If you're taking sort of a more corporate favor side, you know, United is not a monopoly, right? On the insurance side, I mean, there's plenty of other insurance companies in each state. There's the Blue Cross, there's Anthem, there's Cigna, there's Aetna. So I'm very curious to see how this plays out. But from the entrepreneurial world, I worry that because United is actually one of the most active acquirers of companies in the digital health space. And so what happens, you know, I think that's going to come to a freeze here. And you've got the public markets are frozen, but this is a pretty big hit to our industry, I think, if you just take the entrepreneurial innovation perspective when you look at this.
It won't be easy to bounce. It won't be easy for them to bounce back. That's for sure. I think both on the provider side, the founder side, there's been a lot of loss in trust and looking for new solutions and new alternatives. I think finally people are realizing this is being so dependent on one software vendor. Maybe I need to figure out another backup option. So I do think that, you know, it's a product where there is a high switching cost and you need some sort of big change to push to move. And so I do think that this could potentially, and I don't remember the name of it, but there's like a YC company that has a competitor and they're trying to get the word out that like, hey, like we can be an alternative to change healthcare, you know, taking advantage of the situation.
Well, I know my companies are moving to Availity, for instance, like just to, you know, for part of the eligibility check-in and what have you. I mean, people are having to seek alternatives pretty quickly, but talk about a twofer, like you've got antitrust, you know, action, and then all of a sudden something where you have a pretty large monopoly position in change, or at least a pretty substantial position, has gone down. Tough week. What's your favorite story of the week, or at least one of your top three?
Least favorite thing. All right. So the World Health Organization announced that there are now more than a billion people considered obese around the world. And we know that is linked to numerous serious health problems. So that kind of news, that milestone, that terrible milestone for us, but kind of coming at a time where we actually have a very promising treatment that has never been easier to lose weight. Not saying it's easy, but it has never been easier. GLP-1s are quite promising, and now they're approved for obesity, but they're expensive, $20,000 a year and a lot of the health plans aren't covering it, right? So they look at it, if your member is going to be on your health plan for 4 years, they're not going to see that ROI soon enough to make it worth it. But in terms of your outcomes, lifetime outcomes, if you're able to overcome obesity, you're going to have a better better, healthier life.
Yeah, I mean, the date, not only just the dramatic weight loss, and I'm sure you've had friends who've been, I mean, it's incredible how it works. It is a miracle drug in some ways. You have to stay on it because, of course, most people reverse back if they come off of it. So your point, as a chronic disease at the price point currently, it's unsustainable for our system. But some of the data around how it's affected cardiac health, right? And now kidney disease. I mean, actually, I think in certain populations, as an insurer or a risk bearer, especially as the federal government, Medicare and Medicaid, you might be able to justify the cost of the drug if it's going to prevent kidney disease and someone crashing dialysis. So I think that's going to be the interesting, to your point, the sort of health economics jigsaw puzzle that's going to play out over the next couple of years. But then in 2031, these drugs are going to become generic. And that's when I think it's super exciting, right? Unfortunately, we have to wait 7 years. That's going to be the thing that's going to be interesting to see how it plays out because people are demanding these drugs. And so I'm very interested to see how it's sort of like the payers push back on it.
Do you think that they'll just keep the price high until then? They're just trying to recoup as much as they can until it goes generic.
I think that's generally been the behavior of pharma companies, right? They've spent a ton of, it takes what, 15 years, 20 years, and I think $1 billion to develop a drug on average. And I can't imagine that these drugs are cheap because they're biologic. So they then have a patent, right? And they are.
Yeah. But how much do they cost if you take them for diabetes? Like, is the price of, because Ozempic is the diabetes drug. Wegovy is the same formula, higher dose specifically for obesity, right? Is there a price difference there?
I know generally the drugs are $900 to $1,300 a month. I don't know the difference between Ozempic and Wegovy.
Okay.
But I think, you know, some insurers, yeah, if you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, they'll obviously cover it, right? So it's on now it's on an insurance payer by payer basis. But I think for those diseases, it's going to, the sort of health economics of you pay X now, you get Y back in savings around preventative cardiac event or frankly kidney disease. I think the math will work. I haven't actually run it, but I think it'll work.
I mean, I think it's just problematic in that people don't stay on a health plan long enough.
Totally agreed.
Right. I think it's like a 5 to 10 year time horizon of
Yeah,
of
it's why
ROI.
Preventive health has never worked in a single payer system, it would make total sense. In our system, it makes no sense. You know, the interesting thing is I think there are companies that you and I know really well, like Averta Health or Form Health. And what, you know, they're trying to kind of, I think about them as managing this issue in a different way. Form, for instance, will use some of these GLP-1s, but they'll also use metformin and they'll wrap around a chronic care obesity management service. So it's not just you're taking the drugs, it's you're working on behavioral counseling and nutrition. And if you might have a gut health problem, whatever it might be, they work on it with you. And what they've actually found is the data on metformin, which is costs pennies on the dollar, right, compared to GLP-1s. Actually, it's pretty interesting. It's, you know, not as good as GLP-1s, but it's very close. If you see like a 20% weight reduction on GLP-1s after 12 months, you see like 15% with metformin. And so I think some of these companies that are trying to, you know, manage this with drugs, but without that, that's exciting.
Great. I think if GLP-1 manufacturers have more competition, then maybe they'll bring down their price and make it more accessible. Yeah. All right. So
well,
what's your next one?
I have a positive story right now because we did sort of two negatives.
Yay!
Yeah, I know. You and I like to keep it cheery.
Let's go positive.
So I was super excited. And I know you followed this company for a long time to see how Hims has been performing in the public markets. You know, for a long time, and I used to say it, shame on me, I'd say sort of DTC, direct to consumer, is DOA in healthcare, dead on arrival. And I hate to say that because honestly, I think there are a few things that are going to move the needle for our industry, and getting the consumer involved is one of those, right? Value-based care might be another one. Maybe we'll talk about that. Obviously, the digitization of the system is key, but bringing the consumer into the healthcare economy is critical. We know in all other industries, when consumers shop, they shop based on price, as long as they view the sort of service relatively equal, right? And that friction doesn't exist in our, and that force doesn't exist in our industry. So anyways, Hims is a bellwether company, which had some challenges, went IPO via SPAC, you know, which obviously a lot of the SPACs didn't do well, but now all of a sudden is just posting remarkable numbers, like great growth across multiple. It's not no longer just ED and hair loss. Now they're getting into weight loss as we just obesity management. They're getting into cardiology. It's like, I'm just super excited for that because we need a company like that to be successful in our space. So I'm sure you followed that news and you were excited as I was.
Yeah, I was excited to see the founder tweet, and he's always like super transparent on social media, which is great. But if you, I looked it up earlier, and their stock price is still below what it was at their IPO or at their SPAC.
Yeah.
So I think the market hasn't, I think the market is certainly appreciating their focus on profitability. But and to be fair, every company that IPO'd 2020, 2021, literally not a single one is at its stock price then. So we're kind of just like getting back to where we were and trying to kind of earn the gap that was created by the bubble. But yeah, I agree. I'm a huge fan of direct-to-consumer. I love options. The only issue I see with Hims and Roe and folks like that and with my public health add-on, you know, is this idea of like, is it really good that people are shopping for the specific medication? Is it really good that you go and you say, this is the medication I want and need versus talking to provider saying, here are my problems. What do you think you need? And I used to feel kind of strongly about it. And I used to call companies like this pill mills, and I passed on investing years ago because I kind of considered it like, you know, against the grain. But then, you know, I think it's grown on me. And here's one thing. Here's kind of what won me over. I was trying to get tretinoin, the retinol face cream, from Hims maybe a year or two ago. And I thought it was going to be pretty easy to get it. But they actually, they declined me because I was going through IVF. And I was like, okay.
Wow, they had like a protocol.
You know, that would have been easy. Yeah, like they follow the protocols. Like they ask the right questions. And then I didn't have to pay for it. And so I you know, I do think that they do are honest. I hope I never regret saying this, but I think they're an honest company. I think they do have the patient's best interest in mind. And I think they're just doing it differently. And when people do things differently and try to disrupt the status quo, the healthcare industry gets upset. But they've been steady. They've completely added new products and new segments. As you said, they've been getting into weight loss. And I'm eager to see where they go. I don't know if I'm ready to buy their stock yet, but I'm following it.
I think the thing that presses me most is, you know, one is they've had a profitable quarter, which I would assume the customer acquisition costs alone in this space would have been massive. So they're actually not only they're growing top line, but they're doing it so in a way that hopefully allows them to be sustainable and self-sustaining. And then the customer retention data that they reported is really impressive. Like they reported like 85% retention of customers over 12 months, which, you know, like customers, you know, they vote with their feet, right? So the fact that they have 85% retention to your point of, it's probably not just a pill mill, because we've seen other pill mills that like, and I think they've proven that. So we need more of these companies in our space in order to, you know, make the system change.
My turn. Okay, this is kind of a few weeks old now, but huge news nonetheless. A VC fund, General Catalyst, acquired the Ohio hospital Summa Health. And this one is especially interesting to me because it is in my hometown of Northeast Ohio, and some locals are pretty upset about it. Steve, I'm curious from your standpoint as a VC, why on earth would a VC buy a hospital?
Yeah, so first of all, what Hemant and the JC team have done in terms of coming from, you know, back in the day, we're both OGs. I don't, you know, GC had a presence in healthcare, but they're not nearly what they are now. And now they're, you know, one of the more formidable funds. So it's really impressive what they're doing and the health transformation front. On the buy-in Summa, I struggled to understand. I haven't yet heard the long-term vision for it. I really don't quite know. I mean, they'll say it's about transforming health or say it's about changing the way that a system operates from fee-for-service to fee-for-value. And I think one of the interesting things about this asset that they've acquired, this hospital, is it actually is, it does also have an insurance company to it. I think they've got an insurance company that has about 60,000 lives that the hospital also manages, I've heard. So that's kind of interesting in that it's an integrated. So I think that's an interesting thing to play with in terms of an integrated system. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, what's the end game here? It's running a health system. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, it's not easy, right? I mean, it's unionized. It's really low margin. It's multi stakeholder. It's, you know, you got like every single physician is the head of their own sort of, you know, fiefdom, if you will, in their specialty area, and rightfully so. They're masters of the craft. But man, I mean, I don't know what that end game is. And in truth, the best run health systems are actually from a financial perspective, not necessarily from an outcomes perspective, are the fee-for-service systems, the for-profits, right? I mean, HCA and others have continued to produce really good financials even through the tough times. Then the more mission-based systems, which it sounds like this is going to be, haven't done as well over time. And so What do you think? I mean, I guess it's an experiment. I don't know.
I have more questions than thoughts. I will say this, being from Cleveland, my parents live in Akron. So this is like where they live, but they go to, they have, there's the Cleveland Clinic, there's University Hospitals that's associated with Case Western's Medical School. There's just a lot of options already in Cleveland. It is hard to compete in that, specifically in that area, Northeast Ohio. And Summa Health isn't known for being a great hospital. I think it's not someone's first choice. So I don't know if their plan is to turn it around. And certainly I love to see innovation outside of Boston, San Francisco, New York. Like I love that, right? Like if they can do right by patients and build a healthcare system, especially if it has a provider element to it, where it's a value-based care system that serves patients better than.
But do you think your neighbors in Cleveland care whether it's value-based care? Like, is that going to make a difference?
Cleveland is not a wealthy city. Yeah. And, you know, healthcare is out of reach for a lot of folks. And I actually think value-based care would be really good for that population because it can focus on prevention. It can focus on keeping people healthy. And so to me, it would be a great model. Now, what I wouldn't want to see is gatekeeping care because you want to keep the cost down. That wouldn't serve anyone well. But I have to share what a member of Akron City Council said during the meeting. He opposes the sale, citing a moral objection to the use of Summa, its staff, and its patients as guinea pigs for venture capitalists.
Yeah, I know. When I first heard it, I thought it was going to be a lab to test all of these various companies that GC or others invest in. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. But if that happens, I think that's exactly the feeling that patients and members of the community and stakeholders will have. So I guess the end game then is to build a profitable, differentiated health system. And that's a long-term game.
I think it's going to be hard for them to attract providers out of Cleveland Clinic, right? If you're going to, everybody wants to work at the Cleveland Clinic, right? Especially specialists. They want to go to the place that's going to have that brand recognition that can take them further. But maybe they'll be enticed by the opportunity to innovate and do things differently. I don't know. I'm watching. It's interesting. Yeah. It's really interesting. The only last thing I'll say on this, and I tweeted this because there's a lot of objection just because it's a for-profit. And I just want to remind people that just because a hospital is nonprofit does not mean that it does not profit. And private equity gets kind of a bad rep, and some of it deservedly so. But actually, if you look at the data, there's no indication of material differences in the standard of quality of care between nonprofits and for-profits. There are some areas that nonprofits seem to do better and others where for-profits seem to do better, but both types exist on the list of best hospitals in the country and both types exist among the worst hospitals in the country. So I don't think just because it's a for-profit means it's going to be bad.
I know actors here, you know, Mark Harrison, Haymont, his team, this is a big, bold bet, but it's not something that they necessarily needed to do. I think they really do believe in transforming healthcare. What I'd love to hear as the next is like, okay, what's that actually mean? Like, how are we going to know year one, year five, year 10, year 20? Because this is going to be a 20-year thing. It's clear they don't care about, or at least their LPs in this entity don't care about near-term returns is what I've been told. Like, I'd love to have that vision. So,
who are the LPs, by the way?
I don't know. I've heard it's an SPV. So, I mean, they retired $800 million of debt. That's Summa, to your point, was having financial challenges. So, and I'm sure they had to put additional money onto the balance sheet for working capital, right? Because these are expensive institutions to run. Yeah. So it's a big swing.
I would have loved to see that pitch deck to those LPs.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should have them on the show.
We're working on it. We're working on it, Hallie. This is a call out.
We'll be right back after the break.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Final one for me was, it's actually on this theme of value-based care, and it's one where I, you know, it's something that I've always really wanted our system to make progress, but, you know, the recent announcements for VBC haven't been that positive, unfortunately. This week, Privia stock actually went up. Privia, which has been a leading provider in this area, actually went up because they shifted their near-term focus away from value-based care, given sort of the market dynamics. There's lots of speculation around ACO REACH and whether it's a well-structured program. You know, there's been lots of publications that show that most of the federal government's models around value-based care haven't produced real results. Obviously, lots of headwinds to Medicare Advantage, which in and of itself is a bit of a form of sharing risk, you know,
yeah,
so
absolutely.
Village MD, yeah. Kano, all these things. I mean, I'm sort of bummed out because I think VBC has been one of those things that a lot of investors, entrepreneurs, policy leaders have hung their hat on. And I'm curious, where do you think we are? Like now that we're 12 years into Obamacare, is that right? And probably
yeah.
20 years since, you know, this has been talked about. Like, where's your view, Hallie, in terms of VBC? Are you still a bull, a bear?
I think value-based care is the only direction we can go. Certainly there are things that still need to be fee-for-service. I'm not saying that they don't, but in terms of your everyday care for primary care, for specialty care, I think that we have to move to a model of value-based care. Where I see us most getting hung up is how to actually operationalize that and how to actually track and measure outcomes and the relationship between the payers and the providers that are the ones actually providing that care.
Okay, so what do you need? You need technology in order to track this. I feel like there's lots of progress we made, but I feel like we made a lot of progress as an industry in that front. So I feel like you need physicians who are willing to take on risk. I think we've come a long way in terms of like, and kudos to some of the early primary care companies, the Chen Meds, the Oak Streets, the Allidades, who have gotten physicians there, right? Obviously, you need the clinical protocols, right? You need to invest, to your point, in preventative care. Think about the holistic journey of a patient with chronic comorbidities, right? You obviously have to invest in primary care, which we have done. But then I think you need to finance these things the right way. And I'm not talking about venture capital financing. I'm talking about like programmatic financing at the public level, like CMS, right? Like, because there's a real J curve, meaning that there's real lots of investment that you need to make, right? And you know, you need to, in order to transition from a fee for service system, in essence, what you're doing is you're taking less revenue now, right? Because you're not getting paid on every knee procedure, every time you see Hallie to scope her knee, but you have the cost of treating Hallie, right? And then ultimately over time, you get paid back.
But could you not get paid up front? Could you not say, here, you're treating Steve for the whole year.
Full capitation
we're
you're
pay
talking
you up front
about. Yeah.
Yeah,
but a lot of those models now, a lot of the models aren't there yet, right? And a lot of the models are like, let's look back and see how much savings you've provided. And, you know, we got to look how you're doing against the benchmark. So, yes, you get paid some up front, but you don't get paid the full nugget.
Yeah. They need like inventory financing the way Shopify accounts have.
Right. We need some kind of creative financing mechanism. And I think it's a public good. The problem is it's a lot of money, but that's what's been missing to me.
Yeah. I think it's such a good point. So when I think about kind of Obamacare, when that all came out and the formation of the ACOs, one of the tenets was everybody will be insured so that the actual pool will include the healthy people as well, which was great, right? Like we solved a huge problem there. The problem we didn't solve was the time horizon problem that we spoke about with the GLP-1s. And that's the same thing here is like, we still have in your entire life, I don't know if anybody's ever done research for this, but I would imagine already at 40, I have probably been on 15 health plans, right? And I think that's pretty normal. And so you're bouncing around every year, every 2 years, every 4 years, based on your job, based on if your employer switches plans and whatnot. And certainly if you're in your 50s, a lot of these health plans are like, let's just pass the buck to Medicare. We can just wait for that. And so we still haven't solved that issue. I don't know how to solve that issue. I don't know if you have the answer to it, but we've been able to get everyone covered, but we haven't been able to get covered in a way that your insurer cares about you, not just this year, but cares about your health in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road.
It'd be like some massive longitudinal risk adjustment formula where like you'd have to you pay into some pool as an insurer, and then every year there'd be a reconciliation of, How much of the cost burden have you borne at that one time?
Oh my God, Steve, we just solved it all.
I'm not that good at health stats, unfortunately.
It's like a 529 plan. You're putting the money in there, you know, someone's managing it, and then you use it when you need it. But I think that's the biggest issue here. And I see with value-based care as well is like you still,
by the way, they need
still
to
have the time
so
horizon
my
problem.
One thing, the reason that I hit on the financing point is like, I actually think as a system, like I said, we've done a good job in digitizing our industry. We've talked earlier about HIMSS. We've done kind of a crappy job, but let's hope HIMSS and others push us forward on bringing consumers in. I think VBC, it's mixed. Right? Like on the primary care side, I actually feel like we made a lot of progress. If you and I sat here 10 years ago, younger Hallie, younger Steve, and we were talking about it, we would be like, I don't know. Now I feel like we've done a good job. Now we got to move it to the point you made, to specialty, right? We got to move it to specialties. It's starting in kidney. We got to do it in oncology. We got to do it in cardiology. But guess what? Those costs, that J curve is a lot steeper because the costs of everything that they do is much higher than just average primary care, right? Because the patients by definition are more sicker because they're coming to them. So I think in order to make this happen, especially where it actually is the huge center cost for our system, like this financing issue is going to have to be solved sooner rather than later, or else we're going to only stop at primary care is my fear.
All right, last one. And then we'll talk about some interesting deals. I think we're at the last one, aren't we? Yeah. Well, I can't let this podcast go without being disgruntled about the Alabama court ruling on frozen embryos. I did a quick special episode on this only because I'm on the board of Resolve, which is the largest infertility nonprofit that does advocacy, has worked on legislation and advocacy for over 100 personhood bills since 1974 and has been successful until now because of Roe v. Wade's not there to stop it. And also, I would literally only be a mom today with IVF. I've never been pregnant without medical assistance. And so it just breaks my heart that the Alabama Supreme Court, starting there, because we know other states are going to come after IVF as well, think that fertilized eggs should be considered children, which for a whole host of reasons, if you're interested in why, you can listen to the episode 2 weeks ago. But it is just super disappointing to see just overreaching religious rulings that, and you know, infringe on our rights to medical care.
I also have nieces who I wouldn't have if it weren't for IVF. So I personally and have actually invested in this space a long time ago. It's actually an amazing advancement in science, which is so important to many people's lives. I'll show my political stripes. I hope that this is used against folks who want to prevent this from happening. Like IVF is a very important, it's science-based, it's a very important procedure. And frankly, I think the Democrats had success when they ran on Roe and put it on the ballot in each of the states. And I think this is only going to up the stakes for, frankly, the most important voter population is women, right? Independent women, women of all stripes. And this is a issue for men and women, because as we know, by the way, a lot of people think IVF is a woman's issue. We know actually it's actually both factor, male factor and female factor. So this is a male issue too. So I just hope this is like, this is, you know, you thought it'd end at Roe and now we're here. And it's like, geez, man, you can't believe this.
I literally wrote something like warning people after Roe, like, hello, this is actually, this does impact. Because if you consider an embryo a full human, then what happens that, you know, you freeze embryos. Does that mean that you're, is that child neglect to freeze it? Then do you have to transfer it? So just quick kind of anecdote on, so Italy, very Catholic country. They banned IVF for a while, or not banned IVF. They banned
embryos,
freezing embryos for a while. So what happened was you had to, at that time, every embryo created was considered a life and it had to be transferred. And so they saw an increase in multiples, which, as you know, massively increases the health risk for the mother and worse outcomes. And it was more expensive. Like, so it made IVF care like less accessible, more expensive, more dangerous. IVF is extremely safe. And we transfer one embryo that has a pretty good chance, if it's euploid, if it's genetically normal, has a pretty good chance of working. And when you take that out and you kind of rewind that science and transfer a bunch of embryos and someone has triplets, quadruplets, it's wild. That is not medically advised. So Italy actually went back on that and they realized that was a mistake and they rolled it back. And so hopefully Alabama will too. I did hear that they extended until until summer 2025. They've said that nothing will be enforced until then, until after the election, conveniently.
I don't think, by the way, I don't think it stops at Roe and IVF. I think this is a, people who believe the world should be male-driven. And I actually think it starts with lots of women's rights issues, honestly. I think there are lots of reasons that people have for this view, but I worry that it goes farther than this. And so for, as someone who's raised by a powerful woman, it's like this is like, I agree with your it's really scary. And I think there are forces behind this that are not progressive and just, so.
Yeah, well, I have my EU citizenship to fall back on, and I will leave if it gets worse. I'm sorry. I'd like to fight for women in the U.S., but from afar.
You're leaving just
afar.
After we announce you co-host.
I could still co-host from Europe.
That's
I'll just be somewhere where we're not dependent on cars and there are no guns, and I have the right to an abortion if I can ever get pregnant unassisted.
That sounds like a good place.
So, all right. Well, to wrap up today, one of the things we wanted to do is just share a company that we're excited about, self-promote a company that we've recently invested in. I thought maybe we could just like say one company that we invested in that we're excited about recently, maybe one that's not or whatever. Yeah. Let's just plug some cool companies.
So, and we won't always plug our own companies, but actually a company we had invested in that I think is the largest raise this year in we're one of them is Abridge. We are actually going to have the founder CEO of Abridge on Heart of Healthcare. So we'll let him tell the story, but they are a leading company in the use of AI, generative AI to automate physician notes. So we've all been to the doctor when the doctor has to turn away from you and type the note into the electronic record. Abridge eliminates all that by using, voice-based technology to record the conversation, then automate the note. And so allowing the physician to focus more on you and your care. And you can imagine all the things you could do once the note's automated. They just raised a very large growth round and they're doing great. And I'm sure...
How many doctors are using it?
There are thousands of doctors using, but I can tell you that the number's not official, but it's really interesting, Hallie, to go back to when we started investing and doctors were really skeptical of adopting technology. It's actually coming a long way, and it's amazing now that generative technologies can actually make their lives easier, like truly make their lives easier. Less time on task, less pajama time, if you will. I'm sure you have doctor friends who have to go home and like type notes on nights and weekends.
Miserable.
So now it's amazing. So Bridges, I can tell you their pipeline is full of leading health systems that you would know.
Okay. I was going to ask, like, can a physician just sign up for it or does it have to be the health plan? Has it to integrate?
Interesting enough, Abridge started when we first invested, they were direct to consumer. So they were marketing to patients, especially think about if you were diagnosed, unfortunately, of cancer and you're there and it's just all these terms are being thrown at you. And
Gosh.
Abridge actually was a direct to consumer company at first. And so they built a product that is consumer grade, but now, obviously, and our world is dominated by enterprise sales. Yeah. And so now they're taking that technology.
Can consumers still use it, though?
Yeah.
Do they still have it?
Yeah, my colleague Morgan, who you've interviewed, actually uses it. His system doesn't cover it, but he uses a doc to do rounds. So,
Cool. Yeah. Great. I usually take notes on my phone, but I feel bad because I'm like looking down at my phone. And so it's just kind of awkward, but I love that. Cool.
Thanks.
Well, congrats. Congrats to them. Looking forward to hearing them on the show. Okay. The company I want to share is one that I invested in late last year, but just kind of announced and kind of came live recently. So it's Alchemy Health, and they help build and operate on-site pharmacies for 340B covered entities. So that is the 340B drug pricing program. It's a federal program that requires drug manufacturers to give discounts to hospitals and clinics that serve vulnerable communities to help kind of bring down that cost for the most vulnerable patients. It's the only place in the government where they're actually negotiating prices on medications. And it accounts for about 5% of all medicines purchased in the US, but no one really knows about it. I learned a lot about it last year. I didn't know much about it before. So what Alchemy does is it helps these STI clinics, these Ryan White HIV/AIDS clinics, and other federally qualified health centers set up their kind of own pharmacies and dispense medications to their low-income patients. So it was started by a pharmacist, Susie Crow, Peter, who is a fellow HBS grad, and he worked for East Africa's largest HIV care provider, and Sid, who is the co-founder and CEO of TruePill. So really cool team that comes with a lot of great experience, and they recently launched, and I'm just really excited about the work
great
that
they're
doing.
I know Peter from school and know Sid, and just great people focused on a A very, very important problem. I love the customer, end customer they're serving. Like 340B has been a very it's actually been one of the few places that health systems have made money, but I love the fact they're taking it to, you know, sexually transmitted disease clinics and FQHCs, which are federally qualified health centers, where they really need, they actually really need those profits. And the people who go there really are, you know, eligible through 340B drug pricing. So I think it's like one of those awesome win-wins in our industry.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, and I know some folks in pharma don't like it, right? Because they can, the pharmacy can kind of keep the difference, right? The pharmacy
slash
provider can kind of keep the
difference. Well, we just talked about how pharma's doing all right on GLP-1s and other.
Exactly. Like, these are nonprofit clinics that, like, okay, if they make a little bit on the top of these medications and they're still providing it at cost, like, we can just, like, this is like required charity from the pharma who just charged too much anyways. So anyhow, well, Steve, this was a really fun first episode, and well, you're going to take on the next, I think, interview, and then we'll be back again in
April. See y'all in April.
Awesome. Bye. All right. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Heart of Healthcare. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. The Heart of Healthcare is produced by Hallie Techo. The show is engineered, edited, and mixed by Kyle Moore. Visit our website, heartofhealthcarepodcast.com, for show notes and episode details.